Okay, let us begin. Our topic for this year will be Israeli political history. And our topic for tonight will be the political landscape of the Yishuv on the eve of independence. This course will not be a military history course. I don't know anything about that. I mean, we could try to, you know, go into issues of various armed conflict, but it's not for tonight, and we're also not even going to focus on the major issues in the social history of Israel. This is going to be a political course, because the politics of Israel, in my view, are very exciting. In Israel, on May 14th, 1948, a state came into being that was a democracy on day one and has remained a democracy for the last 70 years up until today. A flawed democracy at times, one you could complain about, but still, the notion of the popular will being represented in government has been important all the way through. This might come as a bit of a surprise, because many of the countries that came into existence after World War II and made an attempt at starting as a democracy, at one point along the way, lose that status and become a tyrannical regime, or just a regime that is not responsive to the will of the people, doesn't hold regular elections. Israel somehow has been able to hold on, even in an environment in a region of the world that's atypical. What's even more surprising is that the population of the state of Israel at its founding was, for the most part, full of people who themselves did not have a personal history of participating in democratic society, or rather, I should say, a democratic country. Because who were these people? Of the 650,000 Jews in Israel on the eve of independence, a significant percentage of them had come from Tsarist Russia before the Soviet Revolution. A significant percentage were from the Middle Eastern world, were Sephardim, didn't have democracy. Others came from other states in Eastern Europe or even Central Europe that had problematic history with democracy. And some did come from interwar Poland and interwar Lithuania, where there was, at least in the 1920s, a functioning democracy, including Jewish political parties. Huh? And Czechoslovakia, yeah?
Rabbi, yeah. You mentioned the Weimar Republic and the Jews who successfully left Germany.
Okay, so we're going to mention them. We definitely will get to that. That's the new Aliyah party, the fifth Aliyah. So in Palestine, 1920 to 1948, there is no democracy when it comes to ruling the country. The British rule it as a mandate given to them by the League of Nations. And they don't have to be responsive to the will of the people, at least not to any major extent. And in fact, the Jews and Zionism was one long struggle against democracy in Palestine. Why? Because the Jews are the demographic minority. And if you impose majoritarian rule, guess what? The Arabs win and they kill the Jews. So Zionism in the 20s, 30s, and 40s is all about postponing the emergence of democracy in Eretz Yisrael until such a time as the demographic numbers work in favor of a Jewish state. Okay, so where then was the democratic tradition and the political and partisan tradition that was so vibrant on the eve of statehood? Where did it manifest itself? The answer is in three places, yeah. Of course, democratic socialism is an important movement. So three areas or venue where you have the opportunity for partisan politics and electoral politics. One is the Zionist organization, the World Zionist Organization, which has a congress every so often, oftentimes every 2 years. And these are with delegates, and the delegates are elected by a ballot box. So parties run, and they have a slate of candidates, and they go to Basel or to Geneva or to Zurich, wherever the conference is being held that year, and they give they say their piece. That's one area, World Zionist Organization. The second is the least important for our purposes tonight, the Histadrut, the Workers' Union. The Histadrut HaKlalim HaShel HaOvdim Be'eretz Yisrael, General Organization of Workers in Israel, which was founded in 1920, which we'll discuss why in a moment. But that had partisan elections. You ran a slate of candidates, and you were put forth on the leadership of the Histadrut. But the third area is the Jewish community of Eretz Yisrael, Knesset Yisrael. The Knesset Yisrael was supposed to include all of the Jews of the land of Israel living under the British mandate, to get together in a political organization to represent the wishes of the people vis-a-vis the British, and also to conduct their own internal affairs, whether that be health or welfare or religion. The chief rabbi is an employee of the Knesset Yisrael. So this is going to be on the basis of electoral politics. How often are there going to be elections? Well, not all that often. Why? Because it's not easy to get all the parties to agree to the terms of elections. Can women even vote? That was a big question in the 1920s, with Rav Kook being opposed to women's suffrage. So there were elections in 1920, in 1925, in 1931, and then not again until 1944, because for 13 years, again, postponement after postponement of the elections for this Knesset Yisrael. Now, who was elected?
What about the Jewish agents?
We're going to get to that. That was not very democratic. It was insofar as the Jewish Agency executive is basically the same thing as the Zionist Organization executive. It wasn't originally, but it became that after the merger in 1929. So the elections for the Knesset Yisrael were for the Aseifat HaNivcharim, the Assembly of Representatives, which was between 200 and 300 people, based upon party affiliation. And by the way, the Ashkenazim and Sephardim could not run on the same list. They were separate communities and therefore had to run on separate lists, which plays a role in early Israeli politics in the first few Knesset elections of there being ethnic parties that don't do all that well at the polls. And this Aseifat Nivcharim would then choose a council, a Jewish national council called the Va'ad Le'umi. So the Va'ad Le'umi is the executive that basically runs all the internal affairs of the Jewish community in Israel, in Palestine.
They serve at the pleasure of the mandate.
They serve at the pleasure of the people, the Jewish people, not the mandate. The relationship with the mandate was primarily that of the Jewish agency. The Jewish agency was called for by the mandate. It was supposed to be a Jewish agency and an Arab agency. The Arabs kind of, you know, punted and messed up for themselves. The Jews established an agency. It then merged Zionists and non-Zionists in 1929 to have an expanded roster, and then basically became the same thing as the executive of the World Zionist Organization, and by 1933 the socialists take over, and by 1935 Ben-Gurion is the chairman of the executive and runs that executive till statehood in 48. Okay, so
it may be political, but it seems that the goal didn't have anything to do with going against the mandate. We want to go ahead and make hospitals.
No. The Jewish community, the Jewish community is interested in the survival of the mandate, so long as the mandate will allow for the Jewish purchase of land, number one, and large numbers of immigration certificates. Those are the only things that really matter. Let us buy land. Let us into the country. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, didn't the labor unions, like Mapai and Hapoel Mizrahi, didn't they form the basis of democracy there?
Yes, okay, so we're going to go through each one of the parties individually in about 5 minutes. So, as the mandate is ready to expire, a decision is made on April 12th, 1948, that it's time to create the institutions of state that could become a provisional government when the British actually leave and, you know, take down the Union Jack for the last time and the flag of Medinat Yisrael is ready to go up. You have to have a government in place that can function. So, on April 12th, 48, the Moetzet Ha'am, the People's Council, came into existence. And the People's Council was a merger of the Jewish Agency executive, led by Ben-Gurion, and the Va'ad Le'umi, led by David Remez. So basically, the group that was governing local affairs with the group that was running Zionist policy on the world stage combined together to form a People's Council, and then smaller than that would be a People's Administration, the Minhelet Ha'am, which had about a dozen members, actually would end up with 13 members. and they would become eventually the cabinet, the government of the state of Israel. On May 14th, that's what happens. The Moetzet Ha'am becomes the Moetzet HaMedina HaZmanit, the Provisional State Council, and the Minhalat Ha'am, the People's Council, becomes HaMemshala HaZmanit, the Provisional Government of Israel. Who's in this government? That's the major question. That's what we should care about. You know, when the United States, you have a two-party system. Most people don't really care too much about politics, except today when we're in hyper-partisan time. But, you know, for the most part, America is not like some of those other countries in the world where it's politics all the time and there's a partification of society to the extreme. But there, in Palestine, there was. And people don't really get along, to the point of even violent clashes sometimes. So if David Ben-Gurion is going to be the first prime minister, because as chairman of the Jewish Agency executive, he then goes on to become the prime minister, occupies the most important seat at the table, he has his party affiliation, and his people are going to be in the government. Well, who else does he get along with who could as well be in the government and needs to be in order to form a workable coalition? And who's out? Because their viewpoints are so extreme that they cannot either be trusted with state secrets or cannot be counted upon to play well with others. That's the real issue here. So there was a goal in 1948 in Eretz Israel to have as wide a coalition as possible at the founding of the state, because you don't want to have internal enemies among the Jews in light of the fact that there are so many external enemies among the Arabs and the international community. There needs to be a broad front of our people, Klal Yisrael, Am Yisrael, against the enemies. So that's the big challenge, including as many groups as possible. So what are these groups? Let's try to figure that out now. The main political entity that would hold power for a long time in both pre-state Israel and then the Medinat Israel is what political party?
Mapai.
Good. So Mapai is Mifleget Poalei Eretz Yisrael. And it's founded in 1930. And Ben-Gurion is at the top of the party from its founding until his ouster in 1963, which we'll get to in about 3 months from now when we discuss the 1960s. But that's not the beginning of labor Zionist politics. Labor Zionist politics goes back all the way to 1905. Let's just go back in time a little bit. 1905 is the second Aliyah. And the second Aliyah had a problem with the first Aliyah. What was that? What?
The first Aliyah, the ethos was to work the land.
All right. Okay, so you're right, but you got to flip it around. The first Aliyah did work the land, but then when they got enough cash in their pocket, they hired Arab labor.
That's
not pure enough Zionism for the second Aliyah. The second Aliyah wanted Avodah Ivrit, Hebrew work, and to conquer the soil with Hebrew hands, and not rely upon the indigenous Arabs, about whom we'll have not much to say tonight. Because this is about Jewish politics. We'll eventually have to address the issue of Arab politics in Medinat Yisrael. But Hebrew labor, conquer the soil. So the Hapoel Hatzair, the young worker, has a problem with the old worker, the Zaken, in that the older worker isn't a worker anymore. What is he? He's an owner. He's an employer. And that's terrible. To Shanda in socialist Zionism to be an employer? Okay. It's bourgeois pseudo-Zionism in their book. But in 1906, a different group is established, the Poalei Tzion. And that's Ben-Gurion's original party. This was avowedly socialist. HaPoel HaTzair wasn't necessarily socialist. It was just a workers' party in the sense that we want to work the soil. We want to work the land. But without actually having an economic agenda in terms of the bigger picture, you know, macroeconomics. Just, we are workers, we till the soil. So there was an attempt, several attempts actually, to unite all the workers of Eretz Yisrael in one political party, to advance the interests of the Poalim. And in 1919, the Achdut HaAvodah was established. Labor unity, Achdut HaAvodah. The problem is, as with a lot of political titles in Israel, it's a misnomer, because it was not full unity. Only some non-partisans joined with Poalei Tzion to become Achdut HaAvodah. But the other ones, the Poalei Tzion, still remained distant and apart. So what do? Well, if we can't get together in a political party, how about a trade union? And that's why in 1920 the Histadrut was founded, to be a trade union, to provide for the cultural life and economic life of the working population. And Histadrut went on to become wildly successful, building tremendous businesses, Solel Bonet. Basically it ran the Haganah for many years, it ran health insurance in pre-state Israel. So the Histadrut is very important. They run educational facilities, but they're not a political party. Yeah.
Weren't they like comparable to the AFL-CIO?
Yes, yes.
And let's say Hapoel Mizrahi was a member of Histadrut?
Correct, okay. Correct. So in 1930, the Mapai finally comes to existence. All the various factions of labor Zionism come together in this one grand alliance. But it can't hold. It can't hold because there are many issues on which socialist Zionists are going to disagree with each other. What are some of those issues? I'll give you a hint. It involves world politics.
Soviet Union.
Soviet Union, bingo. What is the attitude of socialist Zionism towards the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics? Well, it depends who you ask.
1930.
So every year is different because, after all, the Stalinist regime changes its tune on matters of Jews and Zionism depending upon the year. Now, on the whole, Soviet policy was hostile to Zionism. In 1913, Stalin famously said, "What's the difference between the Bund and the Zionists? The Bundists are Zionists afraid of a boat ride." But what do you get from that joke? That he hates all Jews, basically, and that the Zionists are even worse. So Zionism was seen as contrary to the great struggle, universal struggle for proletarian society. It was seen as bourgeois, capitalist, because in fact, who were the early political figures in Herzl's time and immediately after Herzl? Western European and Central European Jews who had money in their pocket. All right? The masses, yes, were Eastern European poor folk, but who were the leaders? Guys by the name of Wolfson, who had a lot of money. So, if the Soviet Union doesn't like Zionism, and the Soviet Union doesn't like Jews, and the Yevsexia is persecuting every manifestation of Jewish culture and Hebrew culture, so you would think that those who made Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael would not be very fond of the Soviet Union. And yet you'd be wrong, because Jews are meshuggah, and plenty of socialist Zionists were lockstep with what was going on in the Kremlin. All right, so that's one side of the aisle. Yeah?
Is it a little known that the Soviet Union voted for the establishment of Israel?
Okay.
Because they had a feeling of opiumism.
Okay, so we mentioned last year various theories as to why from 1947 to 1949 Soviet policy changed to include, number one, Andrei Gromyko's speech at the UN favoring UNSCOP, number two, the vote for partition, number three, the vote to admit Israel to the UN, and number four, the sale of arms via Czechoslovakia, and number five, the establishment of diplomatic relations, including having Golda Meir go to Moscow. All those things happened in a span of 2 years, but it was like a flash in the pan, because after that, it was all over. Then you have the doctor's plot, the Prague trials, and Zionism is being persecuted mercilessly in the Soviet Union once again. So that's why plenty of socialist Zionists, although they're not pro-Western, at least not until the 1950s, are weary of being too cozy with a Stalinist regime. There are other issues where socialist Zionists will disagree with each other. And I said I wasn't going to talk about them much tonight, but that is the Arabs. What do you do with the Arabs? So the far left believes in a binational state. Now, a binational state is anathema to mainstream political Zionists who want to have a Jewish state. Okay? The other extreme says we're going to be territorial maximalists. Not only do we want a Jewish state, we oppose partition of Palestine. We want the whole thing. And as for what's going to happen to the Arabs who live in our state, well, we'll worry about that at a later time. In other words, they have no answer. Because that's another aspect of Israeli political history. Don't think every position necessarily is coherent. Sometimes there are major flaws in a partisan viewpoint, and it's not our job 80 years later to try to reconcile it with logic. If they didn't back then, we don't have to do it now. Okay. So in 1944, Faction B departed from Mapai, and they established a new version of Achdut HaAvodah. They were to the left of Mapai. They were more pro-Soviet, they were territorially maximalist, and they were militarily aggressive. That's another important point. The Palmach was associated with Faction B and the Achdut HaAvodah. And they liked to fight back every time there was a terror attack. What do? You pound the other side twice as hard. Ben-Gurion of the Mapai believed in national defense and should be credited for producing a victory in the War of Independence, as we'll talk about. But he didn't always think it was the best idea to hit back twice as hard. So Havlaga, restraint, was a long-time Haganah policy because it was the policy of the Mapai. You don't always hit back as hard as they hit you. You know, strategic calculations and the use of brute force. In 1948, there was another merger. A merger of Hashomer HaTzair, which is about as far left as you can go before you fall over, and the Achdut HaAvodah, and they formed Mapam, Miflegat HaPolim Mouchadot. Mapam became the anchor, the far-left anchor in Zionist politics that would have to deal with Mapai in the early years of statehood, whether in the coalition or outside of the coalition. But they were a force to be reckoned with, and we're going to discuss a little bit more about them tonight.
How many?
48, January of 48.
How many parties made up the elements of the coalition?
The original government was Mapai, Mapam, the religious, but there were three different religious parties, the progressives, at least seven, I think.
And how many today?
Today, off the top of my head, I don't know.
482.
Okay. Okay. So now let's go to those who are the non-socialists. Let's move more towards the center.
They're less today because you can't get into the parliament unless you get a certain percentage.
Right. So the threshold is a lot higher now than it was in the beginning of of statehood. In the beginning of the state, you could have a one seat faction in a Knesset of 120 members, which means that even just barely above 1%, you're getting in. And that would happen frequently in the early Knesset elections. It was less so in the 1970s and 80s when you had two major blocks. But early on, sure, there were plenty of such parties. So the center. One of the great complaints about Israeli politics today and going back 30, 40 years is that center parties notoriously fail, right? Well, you have the left side of the aisle, the right side of the aisle, and you have a faction that emerges in the middle, whether it's Shinui or it's Democratic Movement for Change or it's Kadima or Kulanu or whatever party you have that's fashionable, Yesh Atid even, but do they ever win? No, they don't actually win anything. They just get a bunch of seats, become the third largest party, and negotiate for cabinet positions or throw their weight around. What about in the beginning of Zionist history? Was there a centrist faction that was politically significant?
General Zionism.
So, General Zionism, good. What is General Zionism? Well, Kishmo Kane who? It's General Zionism. In other words, if the labor side of the aisle has a viewpoint on economic matters that is their bread and butter, that's their identity. We are to the left side of the aisle on economic matters. That's what we're going to want for the society of a free state going forward. General Zionists abstain from questions of the economy and maybe even social and religious questions. What are they mainly concerned about? The emergence of a viable Jewish state. In other words, Zionism for Zionism's sake only, and not to advance some other glorious agenda. So who was of that sort? Well, the answer is Theodor Herzl. Real Herzlian Zionism is general Zionism. Okay? And who is the successor to Theodor Herzl? Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann is not a partisan fellow. He's not part of any faction. He's just a standalone guy who rises to the top of the Zionist heap in World War I because of his contributions as a skilled diplomat and his relationship with the British. He becomes the president of the World Zionist Organization and has a long tenure as president. He's ousted for a time and Sokolow becomes president, but then they bring him back in the mid-30s. So for a good 25 years, Chaim Weizmann is a leader of worldwide Zionism without really being associated with any particular faction. But who are his underlings? The general Zionists. The problem is that even if you want to believe in Zionism and Zionism only, and to ignore the other issues, you really can't ignore the other issues. It's impossible. Because there's more to life than just pressuring the British Foreign Secretary for immigration certificates and the possibility of statehood. You have to figure out what is Jewish life in the Yishuv actually going to be. So general Zionism, which emerged in 1922, was divided from the beginning into two factions. Faction A and Faction B. All right. Now, Faction A was the pro-Weizmann, pro-Mapai faction, which basically said that we want Chaim Weizmann to be our spokesman on the world stage because he knows what he's doing, and we agree with his negotiations with the British. And as for Jewish life in the Yishuv, we're basically in agreement with the labor Zionist policies of Ben-Gurion and the Mapai, and we're not going to rock the boat. We may not be personally avowed socialists, but we think they're doing a good job of building up the population and the economy. Whereas Faction B says, Weizmann? Weizmann's a pushover. He's too soft with the British. We want a tougher negotiating stance. And as for the labor Zionists, they're going to steal everybody's private property. We need protecting property rights. We need the rule of law. We need a Western society here. None of this Eastern European socialist garbage. That's what Faction B was all about. Now, what happened to them? So, Faction A, which was softer, more to the left, you know, slightly to the left of center, became the Progressive Party. The Progressive Party was a merger of those general Zionists and the German New Aliyah Party. Who are the German New Aliyah folks? Well, this is where it gets a little tricky. Is everyone in Israel in 1948 necessarily a Zionist? I mean, put aside the Haredim. Put aside the Haredim. Are all the other Jews Zionists?
Define the Zionists.
Someone who had a motivation to move to Eretz Yisrael out of the desire to establish a Jewish national home and possibly even a state. Okay. All right. Okay. Good. All right. Good, good, good. 45 was a Jewish population was probably about 600,000. 48, 650, 670,000. So the answer is that many European Jews left Europe and went to Palestine because they wanted to escape for their lives.
Right.
Now, did that necessarily mean before they left they weren't Zionists? No, it could be that they were like lukewarm Zionists who, like all the American Jews, don't actually move to Israel. So they were happy to be in Poland or wherever, and they were nominal Zionists. But when push comes to shove and the gun is at the door, you get out and you go to Eretz Israel. Now, that's true for plenty of Polish Jews, but what about the German Jews, especially the assimilated types, who had spent the last 100 years disavowing Jewish nationalism passionately because they were real Germans? Well, when they end up in Eretz Yisrael, it's kind of a bizarre situation. They're exactly where they didn't want to be. Speaking, there was a significant population. The Aliyah in 1933, 4, 5, and 6 was very heavy.
Okay, so they came before. You're talking about the ones that came before.
Before Kristallnacht, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
But I would think in 1945, you want to go to America, and if you can't go to America, you might as well go to Israel.
So it's hard to get into Israel in 1945. Suffice it to say, the New Aliyah Party had many educated people who had been middle class or better back in Europe, and who were not, certainly not to the right side of the aisle, because that was fearful, that was fascism, that was what they knew from the Nazis, and so they were afraid of Chayrut and the Irgunists and the Begin types. But they also weren't socialist. They were middle of the roaders who were barely Zionist, if that. But with the establishment of a Jewish state, they're team players and they want to get involved. So the Progressive Party becomes a reliable ally for Mapai. So much so that they almost can't stay in existence because they can't prove that they're actually doing anything independent of Mapai. Remember, in electoral politics, it's not enough that you accomplish something in government. It's that you show how you're distinct from everybody else and that you have to be reelected. That was the Progressive Party's problem. But the other half of General Zionism ran as General Zionists in the first Knesset, in the second, third, fourth, and fifth, until eventually they formed the Liberal Party in the 1960s. Okay, what about all the way over to the left? Communists. They do exist. Okay? But what's a little surprising is how virulently anti-Zionist they were while speaking Hebrew in the Yishuv in the 1920s. Which to me sounds so patently absurd that I don't have any way of explaining it. But the earliest ones were the Mopsim, the Socialist Workers' Party, which was founded in 1919 as a breakaway from Pohel Etzion. And then there was the Palestine Communist Party in 1923, which lasted until 1947 when you had Makay, which was Miflegat Kommunistit Be'eretz Yisrael, the only time that communists used the phrase Eretz Yisrael. Communists are fine with the term Yisrael, because there is a state of Israel, but Eretz Yisrael sounds too Jewish. Eretz Yisrael. No, because Palestina, Pei, Lamed, Shin, transliterated, was the official spelling during the era of the Turks and during the era of the British. But the British threw the Jews a bone and used the Aleph Yud with apostrophe marks as the acronym for Eretz Yisrael. So the communists put the word Eretz in Eretz Yisrael only in 1947 with the approval of Moscow. And then in 1948, with the approval of Moscow, the Maki, the Miflegat Kommunistit Israelit, approved statehood, and Mayor Vilner signed the Declaration of Independence, and then participated in political life for the next 30 years as not a Jewish party, certainly not a Zionist party, but an Israeli party. An Israeli party that could have Jews and Arabs. And usually it was more Jewish than Arab in the beginning, and then later more Arab than Jewish, as things got worse in the Soviet Union.
Even though the Soviet Union was persecuting Jews, they still stuck it out as communists?
Sure, plenty of people did. I mean, this is not, when I say plenty of people, I mean a few thousand. Enough to, at the high point, Maki had 7 Knesset seats. That's nothing to sneeze at, 7 Knesset seats. You know, the National Religious Party would be happy with that number. Which leads us to the religious parties. There are plenty of religious Jews in pre-state Israel. And there are 4 political parties. 4. Count them, 4. There is Hapoel HaMizrahi, which is really a trade union for religious Jews, for Shomer Shabbos Jews, that becomes a political party. There's the Mizrahi, which is the non-trade union aspect of it, just the straight-up politics version. The Mizrahi was led by Rabbi Fishman, or Rabbi Maimon, as he changed his name upon the establishment of the state. And the Poel HaMizrahi was led by Zerach Varhaftig and Chaim Moshe Shapira, who signed the Declaration of Independence and becomes a part of the first government. The Aguda is a very important player in pre-state Israel. Very important. And there are 2 parties. There's the Poel Agudat Yisrael, and there's Agudat Yisrael. By the way, the very fact that there was a party called Poel Agudat Yisrael tells you something very important about the difference between today and yesteryear. Bizmanenu, in our time, it's unfathomable that a Haredi party should have a doctrinaire view on economics. The notion of a workers' party, or even a quasi-socialist party in a religious orbit, Impossible. Why? Because who rules the roost? The Gedolim. And what? They only have opinions on Torah, and they'll develop a partisan opinion on any given policy issue based upon expediency. But they don't have a doctrine that they're following about economics or about social life or whatever. And yet, 70, 80 years ago, you could have a party that was an Agudat Yisrael party, but yet was for the working man, was for agriculture, was for economic and development of land. That was the world of the 1940s. Okay. There were other parties that had religious folk in them, but were not necessarily known as religious parties, and that's most importantly the Sephardim and the Yemenites. Now, the Yemenite Association was established in 1923 and continued to exist in the Knesset until the early 50s. Why did it exist as a separate group? Because the Yemenites are very different from everybody else, and they wanted to preserve their interests, which, by the way, was a real problem after Operation Magic Carpet, when the kids were getting their payas cut off, and the education was a real problem, and they were being secularized against their will. So that's all after the state was established. But even before the state was established, the Yemenites want to preserve their culture, and they need a political representation to do that. Okay. So, of all the groups that I've mentioned, who is not going to fit comfortably with everyone else in a people's council? The communists. Who have I not mentioned yet? Good. Okay. So, the right side of the aisle are the revisionistim. Hatzohar. Hatzionim are revisionistim. It was a party that was established in 1925 in Poland as a breakaway by Jabotinsky from General Zionism. And then in 1935, the revisionists leave the World Zionist Organization and establish the New Zionist Organization, which doesn't really last much at all. But all right, so the revisionists are out of the mainstream, so to speak. They have they're territorial maximalists. They're to the right economically, and much in favor of private property and the rule of law. But the revisionists in 1948 in Eretz Yisrael are extremely weak. They have almost no support whatsoever. Why? Who stole their thunder? Begin. Bingo. The Irgun and the revisionists are not the same thing. Very important. People make this mistake. They think that the right side of the aisle is one big happy family. No, it's not. The political revisionists were like bourgeois Tel Aviv shopkeepers and industrialists who happened to have maximalist views. Whereas the Irgun, and the Lehi for that matter, but let's talk about the Irgun, were a bunch of kids in their teens, 20s, and maybe early 30s who liked to brandish a weapon and fight back against the British and also against the Arabs. And so Menachem Begin, who comes from Poland in 1942 and takes over the Irgun in 1943, isn't interested in the political niceties of the Tzohar movement. So he's going to push them aside and establish upon the beginning of the state the Chirut Party, which will become a force to be reckoned with, and eventually morph into Gachal, eventually morph into Likud, and eventually he'll become prime minister in 1977. But the Tzohar, the old line revisionists, are a forgotten bunch, never to be remembered. Okay, but the Tzohar, because of their association, even just tangentially with Irgun, were not trusted by Ben-Gurion. You can't trust these people. They're going to tell people things that they shouldn't, and the Begin's going to have information that we don't want them to have. So it's a delicate situation. For these reasons, it took some time in the spring of 1948 for the communists and the Tzohar people to be invited into the National Council for the negotiations to proceed and to sign off on a deal. But the deal was arranged, and so yes, of the 37-member National Council, there were communists and there were revisionists. How many were there? So I'll give you the numbers. I'll give you all the numbers. Mapai had 10. General Zionist, 3. Revisionist, 3. Mapam, 3. Progressives, 3. Aguda, 2. Pole Mizrahi, 2. Pole Aguda, 1. Pole Zion, 1. Pole Zion Left, 1. Communists, 1. Sephardim, 1. Women Zionist, 1. Yemenite, 1. And 1 independent. So you see, Mapai was the big group with 10, and a bunch of others with 3, but everybody else is just 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Very factionalized. So, yes, the far left and the far right were brought in, but that's to the National Council. What did they get to do? They get to sign the Declaration of Independence, and then they get to go home. Who really runs the show? The cabinet. And in the cabinet, it was much simpler. Who was in the cabinet of the first government? So, Mapai, David Ben-Gurion, Prime Minister in Defense. Eliezer Kaplan, Finance. David Remes, Transport. And Moshe Sharet, Foreign Minister. What are the other ministers? Two from Mapai, two from the General Zionists, three from the religious parties that joined together, one from the Progressives, and one from the Sephardim. There are no revisionists, and there's no Mapam, and there's certainly no communists. There is Mapam, but there's no communists, and there's no centrist party. Certain groups were left out because they couldn't come to a deal over portfolios. Now, Ben-Gurion had a policy informing the first government, no communists and no Chirut. No communists and no Chirut. Why? Because he simply can't get along with them. There's a limit to how elastic a cabinet can be before it falls apart and crumbles under its own weight. So there was a seichel, there was common sense to the way this was all put together. A maximum broad coalition in a council which has nominal powers, much more narrow where the real authority is being wielded. Okay. So, in the time we have left, actually let's discuss one more thing before we get to political fights. What about the Aguda? The Aguda was non-Zionist. The Aguda was anti-Zionist, you could argue, for a while. How were they brought in? Under what terms did they agree to participate in the establishment of the state?
Giving the chief
rabbi money. Okay. So the Aguda is the furthest to the right, if you might say, in the religious spectrum of all the parties. To their left is the Pohel Aguda. To their left is the Mizrahi. And to their left is the Pohel Mizrahi. Now, who is anyone to the right of the Aguda?
Neturei Karta.
I'm glad nobody said God. Strike that from the tape. But Neturei Karta, Rav Blau, Bloy, Amram Bloy. So they would attack the Aguda as being insufficiently anti-Zionist. Did they have a point? Yes, because after 1945, the Aguda moderated its policy. And Rabbi Levin, Yitzchak Meir Levin, who was a Ger Chassid and would be serving the first government, he supposedly said that he was willing to consider the possibility that Medinat Yisrael was Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu. He then denied it, and I don't know if it was ever said, but it's claimed that it was said and that it was denied. So it tells you something. So the Aguda was moderating its policy. It saw that writing on the wall, there's going to be a Jewish state. We have a lot of our people here. We need to get along with the government. We need to arrange for our religious concerns to be taken care of. And we can only do that if we play fairly. So what were the terms of the deal? In 1947, the deal was this. The Shabbos and the Jewish holidays will be the Sabbath and holidays of the State of Israel. The kitchens in the state institutions, including the army, will do their best to serve kosher food to Jews. The marriage laws, as they had existed under the mandate, which meant no civil marriage, will continue. There will not be civil marriage, but rather the religious institutions of whatever religion you're affiliated with, whether it's Jewish, Christian, Muslim, will be the way you go about your life cycle events. And last but not least, and maybe even most importantly, educational institutions which had existed in the mandate era will be allowed to continue to exist as independent institutions, provided that they satisfy minimal curriculum requirements. So, in the mandate era, there were four educational schools. There was the labor Zionist schools, there were the general Zionist schools, there were the Mizrahi, and there were the Aguda. And the Aguda schools could now continue to exist going forward. They wouldn't be taken over by a hostile, secular Jewish state. That was the greatest fear that the Aguda had, was a nationalization of the school system, which would disallow these private Chinuch HaAtzmai institutions. Okay. And the government would provide a measure of funding. Not all the funding. That's why they would always have to come to America and raise money with the dinners, with the Rav, and Rav Aaron Cutler. But Yes, there's some government money.
Chinuch Hatzmai,
yeah.
The draft issue.
Okay, so the draft issue is a non-issue in 1947. Because who's in the Haganah? Volunteers. Who's in the Irgun Lechi? Volunteers. When there's going to be a mobilization of the citizenry who are of age, then that will be a problem. And in 1948, there is an arrangement made for X number of yeshiva exemptions,
400,
which was later extended to 1,500, which was later extended to sort of an infinite number. But there was never even a thought, never even a thought in the 1940s that there should be an exemption for people on the basis of whatever religious category they fall into. In other words, your religious identity doesn't provide an exemption. It's the yeshiva study that provides the exemption, and there weren't that many yeshiva students because there were very few yeshivas in those years. So this arrangement was made in July of 1947. It was urgent at that time. Do you know why it was so urgent at that time in July of 47? What was happening in July of 47?
The UN committee?
Exactly, bingo. UNSCOP, United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, was in the country at that moment. And they were taking a testimony from all the relevant parties. And the Zionists were very afraid that Jews out of the mainstream politically would be interviewed by UNSCOP and would undo this image that had been projected of a united Jewish community in favor of Jewish statehood. Now, yeah, there were some Jews who were against Jewish statehood, and some of them did testify, including the far leftists of the Hebrew University crowd, okay, the Brit Shalom group. But what about ultra-Orthodox? Well, the strategy of the Jewish agency was, let's neutralize them by giving them some goodies, and then they won't talk, and they didn't talk.
Pay them off.
Pay them off? Okay, good. All right. So, but it was an effective strategy at the time, and it worked wonders. Okay. So, with it, all this said, we have now you now have a feel for what was the political landscape as statehood was about to be declared. So, what were some of the major political controversies that existed in the moment of independence and in the month thereafter, as a war is going on? So just for tonight, one topic that's of interest to me, and that is the use of force. A state, in order for it to be a real state, and not a chaotic one in a situation of civil war, can only have one army. You cannot have competing militias. You cannot have competing militias, and the nature of pre-state Israel was that all the militias had a partisan element to them. Whether it was the revisionist association with Etzel, and for that matter Lehi, or the Palmach's association with Achdut Avodah Mapam, or the mainstream Haganah's association with the Mapai. So this is a problem, and the solution to the problem is the establishment of Tzva Haganah Yisrael, the Israel Defense Forces, and the elimination of all competing militias. Well, how do you transform the Haganah into the Tzva Haganah Yisrael and eliminate the partisan aspect? So this is where we have the General's Revolt. Anyone heard of the General's Revolt? Am I speaking total? I'm foreign to you? Okay. The General's Revolt. In late April 1948, David Ben-Gurion wants to transform the Haganah into a professional army and eliminate certain of the officer corps whom he thought were politically either subversive or unreliable, and replace them with professional soldiers who were more politically reliable and who had experience in real armies. Which army in particular? The British Army. The British Army. These are people who had served in World War II in the Jewish brigade or just in the general British forces, because after all, 30,000 Jewish men served in the British Army from the Yishuv in the World War II period. So this is his goal. He has a problem. Between him and the chief of staff, Yaakov Dori, was the head of national command. The head of national command was Yisrael Galili. Yisrael Galili was a macher in the Mapam, which was a pro-Soviet political party. And Ben-Gurion wants to fire him and have no intermediary between himself, not as prime minister, but as defense minister, and the chief of staff. So he fires him. And the heads of the various departments of the Haganah say, you know, you can't do this. We threaten to walk off the job. So Ben-Gurion says, I can do the same thing. I'll threaten to walk off the job. And what are you going to do without me? And the feeling in 1948 was that Ben-Gurion is irreplaceable. Certainly, you know, on the eve of statehood, the man who had led the Am Yisrael for the last X number of decades could not simply be pushed aside and replaced with some inferior character. It wasn't going to happen. So the threats, they worked a little bit insofar as Galili was removed from his position but was allowed to remain on the general staff of the Haganah in an unspecified role, which was really a marginal role. But then Ben-Gurion's up to it again. In late June, he announces how he wants to replace the sectoral commanders on the four fronts, the northern, the central, the southern, and the Jerusalem fronts, with his guys, including Chaim Laskov and Mordechai Maklef, who was his favorite officer, despite being only 28 years old and of limited talent, according to everybody else. But he was Ben-Gurion's guy. And Yigal Yadin, who's the acting chief of staff, says, no way, this is not going to work. Yadin was not a member of Mapam, but he understood that there was a political element here, that Ben-Gurion is ousting his political rivals and putting in people who are not necessarily the most experienced commanders. So he says to Ben-Gurion, you shouldn't do this. But Ben-Gurion does it anyway. And so the leading generals of the army decide, you know what? If you don't change your orders in the next 12 hours, we're all resigning. So this is a military mutiny against the civilian control of the army. And a disaster. Ben-Gurion says, you know what? I resign. And he just left the job. So for about 6 days, he was off work. And Moshe Sharet took over the cabinet. And there was tremendous uncertainty. And some of the generals were off from their work, too. So this is a real a trouble spot, because there was a truce, a four-week truce in the war between June 11th and July 8th. But on July 9th, the war was going to recommence, and Israel was going to go on the offensive. And you can't have the Minister of Defense resigned at home, you know, curled up in his bed, troubled with his lot in life, which is exactly what happened. Ben-Gurion was home, like in the fetal position, crying, and he doesn't know what to do with himself. And Yigal Yadin had to wake him up and say, snap out of it, buddy, and get back to work, and we'll figure this out. And they did. And Ben-Gurion got his way. His officers were in. The ones he didn't like had to be shown the door. And this was an example of his tremendous power that he wielded for the sake of the state, but arguably also for the sake of the Mapai. Now, a ministerial...
Doesn't that go back to what you really started about? Uh-huh. More of a dictatorial type of...
Yeah, okay. So now, so I'm going to mention now how people complained. A ministerial committee was established, led by Yitzhak Grunbaum, he was a general Zionist, Polish Jew, very anti-religious. He was a member of the cabinet, and he led a ministerial committee to figure out how do we resolve all this before they came to the conclusions. And people offered testimony, and the Mapam fellows in the military said, Ben-Gurion is not a good defense minister. He's micromanaging things, he's not a general, and yet he's bossing us around and telling us what to do. Most importantly, he led us into a disaster of a battle where, you've all been there, Latrun. The Latrun battle of late May was unnecessary in the viewpoint of the military. At least the second, third, and fourth go-rounds of that battle. You know, you lose once, you realize it's unwinnable. You don't do it again and send people off to die. So the leading officers who were not of the same political persuasion as Ben-Gurion said, this guy is not getting the job done. He's interfering you know, don't let him have a director general of the defense ministry. Push him aside and allow the officer corps to do their job. Now, that complaint, in hindsight, seems a little foolish because Ben-Gurion made a lot of good decisions in the course of the war, and ultimately the good guys won, and the State of Israel is established on 78% of Mandate Palestine, and the enemies pushed back to the brink. And Ben-Gurion is given great credit for prosecuting a victorious war. But in the middle of that war, there were people who had problems with him, and he had problems with them. Okay, what would happen to many of these officers? What would happen to the Palmach? The Palmach would eventually be disbanded. And the Mapam complained that this is the Mapai's attempt at taking over every aspect of the state, including the army. So, it's a big question. What was the attitude of Ben-Gurion, and for that matter, the Mapai party? Was it, what's good for Mapai is good for the state? Or was it, what's good for the state is good for Mapai? Those are two very different statements. What's good for Mapai is good for the state is a way of saying, well, we'll do whatever's in our interest, and we'll claim it's the national interest. Whereas the other way around is, we want to do the national interest. And if we're the governing party, and we do well, and the nation does well, then everyone will vote for us. And rightfully so, because we did a good job. Those are two very opposite ways of looking at it, but each one had its adherence. Yeah.
Why does they have to tie in, obviously Ben-Gurion wielded a lot of power, into being the defense minister?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that.
Why does that have to always go...
Okay. That's a very good question, and I might have mentioned this a couple of years ago when we did biographies. The answer is that you would expect in a cabinet, in a government, the Minister of Defense, or the Secretary of Defense, whatever you want to call it, would have some background personally in military affairs, having been an officer in their youth or whatever it was, and be a student of military affairs their whole adult life, and then they grow into the job. So Israel over the years has had many such defense ministers. All right, Ehud Barak was one, even in Netanyahu's government, as a professional appointee. He wasn't even part of the governing coalition, but Netanyahu made him the defense minister just because he does a good job of it. That's what he does for a living. He's a defense man.
They
brought him back because they thought he was this heroic figure in 67. So Ben-Gurion had great confidence in his own abilities. And in 1946, he recognized something that others didn't, that the fight for independence will not be against the British, and it will not even be against the indigenous Arabs. It will be against other Arab states who will invade immediately upon the creation of a Jewish state. Now, today, we look back in time, we'll think, oh, that's a pretty obvious point. But not in 1946, it wasn't. Other people didn't realize it. Ben-Gurion realized it, and so he began to study defense matters. And he was a voracious reader and a purchaser of books, so much so that he went into debt personally over these books, and he didn't know where to store them, and he didn't know how he would read them all. He was a man of the book. And so he became a great student of military affairs, insisted upon having the defense portfolio in the Jewish agency as of the summer of 46. It was granted to him. And between 46 and 48, he was a man of the military. In 48, he continued his role as defense minister, and would so together with being prime minister. In 1953, when he resigns to go to Shdei Boker in the Negev, so Moshe Sharet takes over as the prime minister, and Moshe Sharet is a diplomat. He's not a man of the army. So there needs to be a different defense minister. It was Pinchas Lavon. That didn't work out very well. We're going to spend 3 weeks discussing the Lavon affair. So they brought him back. Ben-Gurion comes back as defense minister, even without being prime minister, for a year in 1955. And then he's back at the prime minister's chair, and he holds both positions until 1963. When he resigns in 63 for permanent retirement, Levi Eshkol takes over as both prime minister and defense minister, because this tradition exists that you hold both portfolios. But that tradition comes to an abrupt end on June 1st, 1967, when Moshe Dayan is brought in as the defense minister, as a professional appointment, as part of expanded of national unity government. And ever since 1967, it's never been the case that the prime minister is the defense minister. It was like an aberration that was invented by Ben-Gurion held on to by Eshkol and then destroyed by Dayan, never to be reconstituted. Okay. Well,
she did a great job in 70s. Really.
Well, Golda was very interested in military affairs and especially in nuclear matters, but she was a grandmotherly type, like a tough grandmotherly type, and she was not. It was not her style or interest really to get involved too heavily in matters of the army. Her love was for the people. Not for fighting, but for living. And so her tenure as labor minister actually was much more to her heart than was her tenure even as foreign minister, which she held for 10 years, which was a waste of time, to be honest, because she really didn't do anything when she was foreign minister. Okay. We ran out of time. I was going to discuss one more issue of the wielding of power. Regalachas, we'll do it right now. And that is the Irgun Lehi and the Altalena affair. Now, we spoke about the Altalena at length for a half hour when we discussed Menachem Begin. But that was with respect to his life. What about with respect to Ben-Gurion and holding of power as a prime minister and defense minister? So his view was that there can only be one army, which means that the various militias have to disband. The Lehi disbanded pretty easily. Their members were drafted into IDF units as individual soldiers. There was never a request to create Lehi units. But Irgun had some demands. They wanted, one, Irgun units within the organized IDF. Secondly, the ability to continue existing abroad, where they had agents that purchased arms and smuggled Jews. There was a tremendous Irgun network around the world. And thirdly, they wanted to continue to exist in Jerusalem. Why? Because Jerusalem is not part of the State of Israel. Jerusalem is its own entity. It's international, at least in the summer of 1948. And so the government doesn't really control Jerusalem. The IDF is not exactly there in proper form. There are Haganah units and there are Irgun units, and so they want to continue fighting. So these negotiations don't work out all that well. The Altalena shows up at Kfar Avitkin. They try to unload the munitions. They get a little bit off the boat, not too much. They go to Tel Aviv. They try to get more munitions off the boat. And then Ben-Gurion issues an order, fire on the ship. They fire on the ship, and 16 people die. It's a horrible thing all around. What was Ben-Gurion's attitude when questioned how could Jews kill Jews? He said, this cannon that fired on the Altalena is going to go into the Third Holy Temple. It's like the Mizbeach of the Third Holy Temple. Why? Because this cannon that shot at fellow Jews established the State of Israel. Because we can only have one state and only one army. So again, was it an example of a Mapai leader doing something in the interest of the state, or the state doing something in the interest of Mapai? It depends upon how you want to look at it. And obviously, from the Chirut perspective, for the next 30 years, it was always, well, they fired on us, we didn't fire on them. They were the bad guys, and we were against civil war. All right, everyone can interpret it their own way. We'll stop here. Next time...